complete.
Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where three Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and with me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
Benjamin Young, beaming in.
And now for this week's conundrum, best and worst recreation episodes. Now, Ben, when you proposed this episode, I was confused at first because I was like, recreation on Star Trek? I was thinking of like holodeck. I was like, what is there to really offer? And then I started thinking about it, and there were so many episodes that popped out of like that delved into like the world of recreation in Star Trek. Now, did you have these in mind when you came up with it? Like, what spawned it originally?
I don't know. I was thinking of topics, and I always usually go back to the most memorable ones on my mind, and the ones I enjoyed the most.
Right.
And this one that I will be talking about later, the game. Well, I mean, it's appropriately titled for one, and it just made me think. Like, there may not be the ones that come to the forefront when you think of Star Trek episodes, but there is no shortage, definitely, of episodes dealing with something to do with recreation or whatnot.
Exactly, and actually this brought up some of my favorites, like, across the series. Now, favorites, somewhat kind of goofy favorites, I'm going to be honest.
Sure.
And I'll get into that, you know, talking about that as we go. But this really brought to me, I first thought of things like three-dimensional chess is amazing.
Right.
But that doesn't really, you know, set up an episode or anything. Or Take Me Out to the Holodeck from DS9. The great baseball episode. But what I really wanted to hit upon with this, which is something that had never occurred to me when I read the topic, it was really just when I sat there going through episode titles, was the idea of pleasure planets. Because that's what really informed what I chose as the best. Now, I ended up going with the episode Shore Leave from the original series, which is where the crew lands on this planet and they're confused what's going on. The White Rabbit is running around from Alice in Wonderland. Don Juan is trying to like pull their female ensign into the bushes. Kirk's old Irish nemesis Finnegan is chasing him around. Tiger's running around. Ultimately, what I like about it is it really tackles the idea of play in the 23rd century. It's this planet where anything you can imagine is brought to life. The Enterprise people just apparently are a little bonkers because they're coming up with all sorts of bizarre things. But it's like a planet where you can revisit like old loves. You know, Kirk has his old like 18-year-old girlfriend who looks like she's 35, named Ruth. She shows up.
They look differently back in the 60s, you know.
Yeah, you know, McCoy shows up with two cabaret girls from Rigel 2.
Sure.
This is actually the ultimate, a slight digression, the ultimate McCoy as, like, pimp daddy episode.
Really?
He has his cabaret girls. The gorgeous young ensign is in love with him in this episode. It's kind of weird because he was, like, 40. And she's, like, 20, I think. It was a different era.
This is a pleasure planet.
It is. Well, it is, but it isn't revealed until the end.
Is this one of the first references to a pleasure planet?
It isn't revealed at first, but a character named the Caretaker comes out kind of near the end after chaos has been reigning for, you know, an hour, and explains to them that it's this place for, that he says they're not quite advanced enough to understand, but it's this planet created for them, for their kind, where you can go and just conjure up anything in your mind and live that fantasy. And, you know, at first Kirk's like, no, we're not going to stay. We just want to get back to the Enterprise. And then old Ruth shows up again, and he's like, well, maybe it is shore leave. You know, start beaming down the crew. And I just love this idea of, like, this advanced nature of, like, adults playing. It's something you don't really think about, but I just, you know, came back from a trip in Las Vegas. We don't get that a lot in Star Trek, this idea of people really cutting loose and even kind of taking a walk on the wild side. Now, we see it in Ryza, which I also kind of want to bring up to kind of go parallel this. The problem with Ryza is I think it's a really interesting topic, like the idea of like sexuality in Star Trek. You know, it's sort of similar to like that place called hedonism, is it? You know, that none of us will afford to be able to go or probably even want to go. But I love the idea that it's a
You're
place...
You're obviously not a libertine.
Apparently not. But I love the idea of a planet where people just, you know, kind of give in to their desire. And that's something that you don't see in a lot of TV, the idea of just being open to sexuality. You know, we're very conservative. We prefer violence on TV over anything to do with, you know, sex or, you know, just fantasy. And I love that Star Trek was willing to go there. I wish we could almost see it in a you know, newer Trek that really dealt with it even more frankly. Because a lot of time these episodes, you know, the DS9 one, Let He Who Is Without Sin, or the Enterprise.
That's not a good episode.
No, or the Enterprise one, 2 days and two nights, which is maybe half a good episode, half a terrible, terrible episode, don't really do a very good job. Captain's Holiday is pretty good, yeah. But it doesn't really tackle the real, that side of it as much. It's more about, you know, Picard just hanging out, you know, meeting Vosh eventually.
It's interesting that you bring that topic up, but like Star Trek's reluctance to deal with sexuality. One of their most influential writers, Ron Moore, he ended up going and developing the new Battlestar Galactica, and he agreed. He did not like how prudish, you know, Star Trek appeared when it came to sexuality, and so he really put that a lot of that in the forefront with Battlestar Galactica. And a lot of parents like were complaining, like, I can't watch this with my kids. He said it's very clearly not a family show. So, and maybe that's just it. Maybe Star Trek just wants to be that family show, and it's maybe difficult for them to broach those subjects when there's so many kids. Honestly, like, I started watching this when I was, like, nine, or maybe eight, you know, so...
But at the same time, it's supposed to depict a future where things like this is addressed, right? Like, taboos are supposed to be lifted on things like sexuality.
Yeah, and this isn't like, you know, like the old sailors pulling into port, you know, for hookers or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's dealt with, like anyone...
Okay.
Anyone would be open to this. Like, this is for everyone in the galaxy, and it's the norm. Tyler's, like, laughing to himself.
There seems to be sexual innuendo expertly inserted into every episode, but...
Yeah. But it's funny, though, that, you know, you're saying about prudish Star Trek. There was actually a Star Trek novel called Destiny, where Risa was destroyed by the Borg.
Really?
That's great. That would have been a great episode.
It really feels like a bit of commentary. But even, like, I was going to say an episode like Justice, which is another terrible episode.
Yes, it was.
But I do love how the crew is... They're there to have fun, and this is not something that, you know, they're, like, giggling and winking, like, oh, look at Riker over there with, you know, that girl. It's dealt with completely, like, adults.
Yeah.
There for a fantasy, and it's the norm. And I just really thought that was interesting. I wish it had been done better.
I can't disagree with that.
Guys, when it comes to, like, the Pleasure Planet episodes, how do you feel?
I feel like... Some of these writers must have been just out of their mind when they're doing this sort of stuff. I mean, there's an episode like Captain's Holiday. I thought that was a fun romp.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously the writers knew it. They're like, you know what? Like, yeah, this Risa place, we've mentioned it. Let's explore that more. We get to Deep Space Nine, and there's an episode like Let He Who Is Without Sin...
Yeah.
And I remember...
Featuring guest star Vanessa Williams.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I remember... I was just about to bring that up because I remember, like, they were really promoting the hell out of her when...
Oh, really?
When they had, like, previews on for that episode. And I had to ask my parents, who is this? And my mom explained that there's a controversy over
her,
like... Yeah,
because Pentos?
Yeah.
And
I was like, oh, thanks, Mom.
She didn't, like, pull it out to show you, did she?
No.
Like a pointer.
But I watched this episode and I was like, it really made me think that, hey, the writer's like, remember how Worf was a total lunkhead in Next Generation? Let's bring him back as a lunkhead. And like, he was just acting like an idiot throughout that episode. And I don't know, there's efforts to control the planet. And I just was like, oh my God, who cares? Like, that was not a good episode. And the thing is, like, there are not a whole ton of stinkers on Deep Space Nine. This is one of their all-out stinkers. Would you guys agree?
Well, don't you think Risa is just a bit of a cop-out for the Star Trek universe? I mean, why is it that they have to have this one planet where they go... Are there others,
because there's obviously the Justice planet. And
that we never return to ever again.
And then the Shore Leave one in the Omicron Delta region.
But they come to Risa over and over and over again.
Sure. Well, I mean, look at Las Vegas. People come from all over the place to go to Las Vegas.
That's true.
But we're talking about the universe.
Yeah, that is quite true. You'd think like another planet would be like, hey, let's get in that business.
Yeah. Because
they seem to be doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Although, at the same time, there's no money or anything, is there?
Well, there's Latin, but it's not universally...
I don't ever think there's any rhyme or reason to this whole monetary system in the 24th century. It makes no sense to me. There were always characters referring to, like, oh yeah, charge credits to the ship.
Starfleet credits.
Yeah, and like, so obviously there had to be some sort of monetary system. Remember that one episode where Picard is replaced by like a replicant or whatever, and then he goes to 10-4, he's like, drinks on the house!
Yeah.
You know, like, it just made no sense. So, I don't know. I mean... Obviously, but here's the thing. I don't know. Maybe if I was in the 24th century, I'd be like, you know what? Let those people have fun on Risa. I'll go to Bali or something like that. You know, that's a little Earth resort, you know?
And I'll just quickly throw in my worst because there's not a lot to say about it. It's the episode Move Along Home from DS9.
As well.
Which is the episode where Sisko and crew get trapped in a board game that Quark is playing.
I didn't mind this episode.
It's a terrible
It almost
episode.
Ended my DS9 run.
Really?
It came very close.
You're saying you would never play Chula?
No. And it's funny because this one is another one that's kind of really hurt by the limitations of the budget and sets. Like, it looks like one of the older, less interesting Nightmare Before Elm Street movies.
It was even like a scaled down version of Temple of Doom.
Yes. Or Nightmare on Elm Street.
I don't know, but maybe I enjoy watching main characters play hopscotch much more than you guys do.
I will say, Tyler, some people did agree with you on this episode.
Thank you.
The Emmy Committee awarded this episode Outstanding Achievement in Hairstyle.
Yes.
For a series.
Those Wadi haircuts were quite something.
And another little bit of trivia for this episode. This one prevented Terry Farrell from appearing in Birthright Part 1.
She was
originally supposed to be in it, but because she had such a big role in this episode, she had to stay and do this, whereas Bashir had like fallen on rocks, or whatever, gotten trapped in rocks, I can't even remember. And so he went and did Birthright.
Wow.
What could have been?
Yeah.
And then, also, Ron Moore watched this episode prior to joining the show. And he said he was wondering if everyone had lost their minds, as you said in an AOL chat.
What's up with the Wadi's makeup? Like, so they're an alien race, but they have some squiggly crayon drawings on their forehead, and they're supposed to be aliens?
Who are we to judge?
I think this is a terrible episode. Inspired, actually, by the episode Checkmate. Of the original Prisoner series, I'm guessing that was probably done better. At least I hope.
If there's giant bubbles chasing after any of the people.
I don't know. But this episode, there's very few episodes of DS9 that I call like a trial to sit through. This is one of them. This one and Prophet and Lace, I think, are the two that were a struggle to get through.
I haven't watched Move Along Home in a long time.
Don't.
I feel compelled to, like, just to see if you guys are right and that the 9-year-old Tyler was dead wrong and he was an idiot for enjoying this as a kid.
Let's chalk it up to first season woes.
Okay. Yeah, that's it. It did give Quark something to do, I guess, in an episode, so I guess it had that going for it. And great, great hair. So, Tyler, what do you have for on the recreation front?
Well, I mean, there's a couple episodes. I think Take Me Out to the Holosuite is an obvious one, but I'm still going to talk about it just a little bit, because what it really emphasizes is that Sisko, I found him always to be just the best developed character among captains, and he was just such a jerk in this episode, you know?
It's great.
And like, it just shows to me like what a flawed character he can be. He comes around at the end of it, like, he's, like, laughing and joking around, like, in the Quark's bar, but he started off as such a jerk, and it was such a great, great episode, like, a showcase for Rom as well, and I found him, I go back and forth in Rom, sometimes I enjoy him, sometimes I find him very annoying, but, and I like Rom's kind of story in this one, and it was great to just get to know a little bit about Sisko's thoughts of, you know, the Academy and all that sort of stuff. But I did find it kind of bizarre that some Vulcan was able to ensure that his entire senior crew was nothing but Vulcans. That seemed a little bit, I don't know, racist, I suppose. But
I kind of love that this episode played up that Vulcans can be jerks.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because you know, that's something that would always get leveled at Spock, you know, or to Paul on Enterprise. But I liked that this one, they really kind of were.
But I love that scene in Quark's bar where, like, Sisko, after, you know, they lost, you know, the game, like, quite significantly, you know, like, he was just still having a good time, and the Vulcan was just like, why are you so excited about, like, not winning? And, like, Sisko's just like, looks like I'm getting under your skin.
Yeah.
You know, and, it, like, there's so many great character moments in this one. I enjoyed this quite a bit. And here's the thing, when we come to recreation episodes, I'm, you know what, you guys, all you listeners, I know I complain about Voyager a lot. Let's go talk about the Killing Game featuring the Hirogen.
It has a cool title.
It does.
This is where the Hirogen species, which we've encountered before, this all takes place off screen, but apparently they took over all of Voyager, and they started installing holographic projectors throughout the entire ship and made the crew take part in like this World War II Nazi like war game sort of thing. So everybody thought they were all like in the French resistance and the Hirogen were Nazis and they're all just hunting them down. I don't mind, you know, when we get to watch the Voyager crew get hunted, you know, so it's, you know, it's enjoyable for me to watch these guys take aim at our crew members. None of them died, of course, but there was a great scene where Neelix, who was, you know, the French resistance fighter, he was bicycling. you never get to see that image too much, but I mean, it shows that Voyager was able, I complain about Voyager so much, but they were capable of doing, like, good standalone kind of episodes. This was a two-parter, but one thing that bothers me a lot about television and movies in general is when it's very clear that somebody is singing on screen, but it's a pre-recorded voice. It sounds like it's from the studio. And Brandon Braga, at the time, he was dating Jerry Ryan.
Portrayed, he was.
7-9. And he thought it'd be a great opportunity to showcase her singing chops. And we get a...
Do you think he did, or do you think she wanted to do it?
Either way, someone pushed for it. It appeared on screen. She's a cabaret singer, and it's a pre-recorded voice, and it sounds so horrible. I don't know if there's many... I mean, nobody watched the show Treme, but that was a series that took place in New Orleans just a few months after the Hurricane Katrina, you know, hit that city. And all the music that show heavily features live music, and none of it is pre-recorded. And that's how you should be doing music in TV and film, is
right.
like if you have the chops, show them off. I hate like having like listening to something that sounds like I'm just listening to a CD or it's auto-tuned or something.
Clearly
like that.
So fake.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it's
fake.
Everybody
yeah.
knows it's fake. It helps me like it's a real struggle for me to suspend my disbelief when I see, you know, somebody singing and they're clearly just lip syncing.
And their voice is nothing at all like the character's actual voice.
Hell no. You know, so it's so frustrating. We had that scene in The Killing Game. But overall, I mean, The Killing Game was a good romp. Again, Voyager, they always go into the old habits of just, like, blowing stuff up no matter what. But, I mean, it was a good romp. We got to pretend it's Nazi era on Voyager. Every Star Trek series wants to go back to the Nazis at
Why
some
is,
point.
But, so it was actually based in the 1940s?
It was, yeah. World War II kind of action.
I thought Voyager was actually one of the series that didn't go back to some sort of, you know, 20th century...
Oh,
flashback.
You thought wrong.
What are you talking about? Tom Paris, he was obsessed with the 20th century on Voyager. And which, what a coincidence. We live in... Well, Voyager started in the 20th century, and he just happened to be an expert. He could comment on everything.
Of course he did, yes.
Yeah.
Did every series go back to World War II?
I don't believe,
did Patterns of Force.
I don't believe Next Generation did.
Yeah.
And the closest we get with Deep Space Nine was Little Green Men, which I believe took place in 1949 with the whole Roswell incident.
Right.
How come they never go back like 100 years rather than like 300 years?
Oh, they did.
Well, remember the whole Q episode where they went back to, Robin Hood?
Yeah.
That kind of era? Like, know, Camelot, you know.
I mean, how often do we reenact stuff from, like, the 1700s?
Well, speak for yourself.
Yeah. No, and, you know, remember Time's Arrow, the that two-parter that capped off, was it season 5 to season 6?
That that dead-on Mark Twain recreation.
I believe Jack London was featured in that one, too.
That's right, yes. That was actually a good two-parter.
Yeah, it was.
I kind of groaned when I read the synopsis before I watched it, and I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a Data's head, you know.
Yeah.
And I love how they attached a 500-year-old head onto Data by the end of the episode.
Yeah. It was, like, goofy, but it was sort of an entertaining goofy. A goofy grounded in character.
I'm actually glad that out of the three of us, you know, you actually watched this show much more recent than Tyler and I, because you must have a different perspective.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
The adult perspective.
And in a weird order, too. Like, you know, obviously me going from original to DS9 to you know, the first couple seasons of TNG, then hopping off and watching Enterprise, then going back. Yeah.
Can't blame you.
Yeah. And season 2 almost broke me, man.
But yeah, I mean, those are my thoughts. I don't know, Ben, do you have any thoughts about Recreation? I know you brought up an episode title early on in this particular podcast. Why don't you expand? Would you care to elaborate?
Yes, no, I would, Tyler. Thank you. The game, yes. Well, I suppose when we talk about Recreation, this may not really fit the mold of what you might think, because it takes place on the Enterprise. Although, if you recall, the episode starts off with, I believe, Riker on Risa, pursuing one of his favorite pastimes.
Yeah, that's right. I actually made a note. Yeah.
One of his favorite pastimes.
Yes, and he's...
In fact, that was one of the things when I said some of my favorite episodes and then proceeded to name nothing but Bad Risa episodes. Yeah. That was actually when I had written down the game and I skipped over. But Captain's Holiday is great. Let's say TNG did Risa right.
They did. And so he's on Risa, you know, and there's a woman chasing him around or whatnot, and she puts on something that eerily looks like Google Glass.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
So,
and this is like 20 years before
exactly.
Google Glass.
When I watched it today, that's what I thought of. Wow, this show just does a great job, you know, predicting what's to come. But she puts this pair of glasses on him, and it shoots this weird laser into his eyeballs. Mm-hmm. And then the little game comes up on the screen, not too unlike what you might find in an iPhone app nowadays, putting a disc into these little weird tube-shaped things. And we're not really sure what happens at the
beginning. Putting a what into tube-shaped things?
Some sort of a disc.
Disc, okay.
Disc. And we're not really sure what it signifies until we get later into the show, and, you know, coincidentally, this is also a Wesley show, just by coincidence.
Yeah.
One of my favorite Wesley episodes, by
indeed,
the way.
Indeed, yeah, because they actually played his character well in this one. But it's showing how the cast goes into this sort of drug-like state, because these glasses obviously have a different intention than what we first thought. And I love these episodes where the characters on the show get to play another version of themselves in this case. And there's no shortage of this on TNG, where the characters get possessed by some sort of alien force or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant in this show when Beverly Crusher, this is also a great Beverly Crusher moment, when she lures Data into sickbay. Because, of course, this game only affects humans, and Data's always the one guy that's not affected. And she lures him into sickbay and asks him to check something on her tricorder. And, you know, for a android that's supposed to be superior intelligence, has superior intelligence, he can't react when the doctor reaches behind and turns him off with a switch on his lower back. Like, he can type like 3,000 words a minute, but he can't turn around fast enough to stop.
He's like, oh no, my one weakness.
Anyway, she manages to deactivate them quite easily, and then progresses to basically infect the rest of the ship through this device. And it's kind of weird how you see all the characters on the ship playing this, like, dozed out, almost a cracked out look.
Yeah,
yeah. I thought that was a great episode, displaying this kind of weird behavior.
It's very suspenseful, and
it was,
you know. And the thing is, if we had episodes like this, like every other episode on Next Generation, it wouldn't stand out. But I mean, this is like.
It's very Invasion of the Body Snatchers-esque.
Yeah.
Where it's like one person after another, you know, begins to act strange.
Yeah.
And that is just a perfect formula for building suspense, you know. It's the 10 Little Indians tradition of, like, one, you know, you go in with 10 and it's like they keep getting offed until you're left with just, you know, one or two. And it's just a great formula.
Well, I recall, didn't Wesley and Picard have, like, a great scene together? It's been a few years since I watched this one, but where, like, Wesley goes to Picard and is like, whoa, let's... What, look his... Where Wesley goes to Picard and he's like, look what's going on around the ship. And then Picard's just like...
Oh, that was a creepy, creepy moment.
Yeah.
Picard's so good at staying smiley and looking... Like his face, like looking like he's still his normal self, but then as soon as Wesley leaves the room, he basically, you know, tells the audience that he's been infected as well. That was definitely a great scene. Wesley, what can I say about Wesley? Well, he has an interesting relationship with a young Ashley Judd in this episode.
Yeah, he does.
I remember her character being quite endearing at watching this as a young lad.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Watching this again now, I was like, wow, she's really annoying.
Really?
Really? Interesting, because honestly, I had no problem with her watching it. Just
her laws?
Yeah.
Robin Leffler's laws?
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah. Yeah, it was...
I didn't mind it when I was a kid when I first watched it.
Yeah. Okay. I still like the episode, but I just noticed little things that I didn't notice 20 years ago when I watched it.
Fair enough.
But... I don't know, there's just so many little interesting things that happened in this episode. I'm curious, what are your guys' thoughts of the game?
I think it's a great, like, suspense episode, like I said. Anything that has, like, a dwindling cast and, like, a group of survivors that have to try and figure it and overcome a problem is just a great formula for, like, just exciting television.
I agree.
And as a one-off episode, it's just, you know, it kind of taps into, you know, a little bit of horror mythology.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... even like a war movie sort of mythology a bit, you know, where it's like the last group of survivors mm-hmm. having to overcome the odds and getting, you know, swarmed. I just think it's a lot of fun. And it's interesting that it is a Wesley episode because traditionally a lot of people, you know, didn't really like the old Wesley episodes so much. And the fact that he was the one person you're supposed to identify with as the survivor was sort of interesting.
And that's true, yeah. I mean, like, we typically don't, like, cheer for Wesley, you know?
No.
And they were able to make us do that. But I do remember watching this as a kid, and, you know, the teaser, it starts out with Riker, you know, getting some hanky-panky on. And as a kid, even back then, I thought, oh, not this again. That episode turned out to be much, much better than I ever suspected it would.
My heart was pounding when I watched it as a kid.
Yeah,
I was like,
what's going to happen next? How are they going to get out of this? You know?
Yeah, I remember Beverly in the corner is like, Wesley, you should try this game. Try this game!
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, everyone did such a good job playing creepy versions of themselves.
And I think that, you know what, it could easily translate to nowadays and be apropos to what's going on with, you know, you walk down the street, somebody's going to cross a crosswalk, they're, like, staring at their iPhone or their BlackBerry or whatever, you know, and maybe there's parallels with people just getting so enamored in kind of electronics, you know, kind of that, quote-unquote, another life, you know, so...
Yeah, and, you know, Star Trek was always really good at predicting the future. And that is something that, yeah, you're right. Like, again, it's like a commentary on something that didn't exist at the time, which is really interesting.
Except for
maybe television. It could be almost, well, I don't think they would have been criticizing television.
But
maybe
yeah.
video games at the time.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty
early. Tetris, oh no, it's going to be the downfall.
It would have been pretty early in the advent of the big console explosion.
That would have been like
NES.
Super NES.
Would have been
era.
Super NES? Yeah, so maybe not then.
But you're right, Tyler, because I think people are so tethered to their smartphones now. It's a very similar, adults, kids alike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially that scene, do you remember Nurse Ogawa in the turbo lift when Wesley's waiting to go up and the doors open and Nurse Ogawa's like, Wesley, have you tried this game? It's
another
great Nurse Ogawa appearance.
There's a character that never got her due.
It was her best appearance after turning into a cave woman in Genesis, I believe.
That was another great episode.
I have to ask, why did we not promote her in the last episode?
Yeah, why didn't we?
It was a mistake on Ben's part. He covered TNG.
I dropped the ball, but there was a little bit strange thing about... So Ashley Judd is like a lieutenant engineer in the other episode, Robin Leffler, and Wesley's a cadet. Yeah, they're analyzing this device, and he's talking about, like, prefrontal cortex and serotonin levels, and they're analyzing the brain. Like, how? I know he's a smart kid, but how are these two able to analyze something on such a medical level? I think
they paid attention in biology class.
24th century, man. I mean, like, think about it. Like, 400 years ago, kids were probably, like, looking at an abacus and trying to figure out stuff. I mean, now,
yeah.
I mean, they weren't, like, learning evolution in school like we were, and, you know, so.
That's true. Anyways, I love how the episode ends by Data saving the day.
Yeah.
Coming into the room, flashing a flashlight, strobe light in his face. Do-do-do-do-do-do. And all of a sudden, all is well with the world.
I wish I could do that as a kid. I remember seeing that scene. I was like, I'm going to bring a flashlight to class. And we're all going to revolt.
He went up in the principal's office. Stop shining flashlights at people's faces, Mr. Orton. Now, I'm curious. Why does this episode work, but, you know, Move Along Home doesn't? Because they both tackle
the
idea...
You're saying that Move Along Home does not work.
Because they both tackle the idea of games gone awry.
True.
What is it about this one that makes it great and Move Along Home that makes it insufferable?
Well, I think TNG was already pretty comfortable in everyone's roles at that point. You know, it wasn't trying to convert an audience at the same time. Whereas I think first season trying to pull something like this, it's kind of risky.
Or is it... I don't know. For me, maybe it's the stakes. Because did you really feel that anyone in Move Along Home was in danger?
No, not really.
And they even revealed then that they weren't anyway.
Exactly. Like, yeah, there was no suspense like this episode had, for sure.
Yeah.
It was more novelty than anything. But do you guys remember O'Brien's amazing appearance in this episode?
Did he have a cello?
Did he? No, I'm talking about when he's just at... When Wesley beams in and he's like, oh, Mr. Crusher, how are you doing? Basically has like two lines and walks off. And I was thinking, wow, classic O'Brien on TNG.
No, I don't remember that. Interesting.
And I think he walks by later and he goes, Wesley, have you tried this game? And he just walks off screen. I'm like, they really utilized O'Brien quite well that series.
But, I mean, it's funny you say that, but they obviously knew they had a great actor. And, you know, they wanted to expand his role whenever they could. And they obviously gave him that position on Deep Space Nine. So it's just so silly. I think maybe they're always trying to find an excuse just to insert him in the series, you know, just... I don't know, maybe keep him working.
It's kind of surprising, actually, with O'Brien that he was on the show as long as he was, because the first season, he's really just occasionally at the console. You know, like, it's amazing that they kept being like, yeah, let's just get that guy back to sit there again.
Yeah. How do they need a guy even to man the transporter room with the technology that they have? He basically takes his finger and slides down.
Well, I'm sure there's more to it than that.
It's science fiction.
Yeah.
Nothing is better than the sad O'Brien meme floating around the internet. You guys have to watch it if you haven't seen it. I have another question, too. So is Synthale actually alcoholic or not?
I don't believe it has, like, the negative effects on people, like a hangover or anything like that. I have to believe that it has some sort of inebriation effect on people, because why else would you drink it?
What about non-alcoholic beer?
Do people really like that?
Yeah,
someone's drinking it because they're making it.
Yeah, but not to the degree that I believe.
Like, for instance, when O'Brien and Bashir always go get an ale at Quark's Bar, what are they drinking?
I believe it's Synthale. And
yeah.
Well, the thing is, we don't really see Trek characters hammered ever.
Exactly.
So, why would you go to Quark's Bar and drink something that wouldn't get you inebriated? Like, are you just there for the fruity flavors, or what? Like,
that's what I always wonder, because those two frequented Quark's Bar quite often.
Yeah.
O'Brien's always like, one more before I gotta go home.
That's a good point. You know, this brings up a topic that I can't believe didn't pop into my head when I was planning, making my notes and whatever for recreation. Why have we not talked about the appeal or lack of appeal of Quark's Bar and 10 Forward?
Oh, well.
Because would you want to go hang out in, I mean, either of those places?
I would hang out at Quark's Bar.
What, you don't like Guinan?
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of Guinan myself.
And their silent bar?
Yeah, nobody really seemed like they were having fun, except for maybe, like, Counselor Troy in this episode.
Eating a sundae or something.
Yeah, she's very creepily eating a sundae.
Yeah.
And, like, almost having an orgasm every time she takes a bite of it.
Yeah. But that's wait, isn't that normal?
No, 10 Ford seemed like the lamest possible bar in the galaxy.
Cool name, though.
Yeah.
Great name.
Quarks, though, it always seemed like there is, like, you know, some fun to be had, whether you're playing, like, you know, Dabo or going up to the Holosuites.
Or
Holosuites, you're right.
There's something to do at Quark's Bar. What was there to do at 10 Ford?
That's a good question. And again, it's like, how did this not pop into my head when I was thinking of, like, worst recreation stuff? Because 10 Forward, I'm always amazed when I watch an episode and they're sitting in this dead silent room.
Where was there to go on the Enterprise at the time?
The holodeck and...
Like, okay, holodeck, 10 forward. Which one are you
I'd
choosing?
I'd rather go to the holodeck.
And come up with a cool bar in the holodeck.
Yeah, my guess is, though, that the, everybody thought 10 forward sucks, so they all booked up time the holodeck. And then everyone was like, oh, I guess I have to go to 10 forward.
It was Riker in there with that, playing his trombone.
And also, you know what's weird? It's because, like, on Deep Space Nine, it was almost assumed that when a lot of clients went to the holosuites, it wasn't just to play cricket or go kayaking. There was some...
play cricket, quotation marks.
Yeah. There was some indication that there was some things...
Erotic activity?
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely. But indication, no. I think it was very explicit. Remember that one episode where, like, Quark was trying to, like, film... Like,
Kira?
Major Kira?
Yes, the Kira
That was
sex.
So creepy. Unbelievably creepy. I think that was Jeffrey Combs was playing
yes.
the guy who was interested in whatever Quark was trying
to sell.
Acquire.
Yeah.
But was there nobody on the Enterprise that ever wanted to engage in that kind of activity, or they just never talked about it on the show in 7 years?
Well, okay. Here's the thing about the Enterprise. You have to look at the captain who sets the tone.
Yeah.
I don't picture Picard... setting a tone where people feel comfortable to talk about that on the
true.
Ship, you know? I mean, not that Sisko was Mr. Loosey Goosey, but...
was
but,
even,
but, you know...
Would that even been allowed on the Enterprise, you think?
I have to believe, even if it wasn't allowed, there's probably dudes, like, getting, like, programs, like...
That's monitored, though.
Well, there was even the episode where Riker goes in and there's, like, a woman in there that he's, like, hitting on and stuff.
Oh, what was
that's the one where
like?
He plays the trombone, I think, maybe
what
the first time.
Minuet? Is that her name?
Maybe.
What didn't he hit on and when did he not play the trombone? In every sense of the word.
Is that a euphemism?
Yeah, I know.
In every sense of the phrase.
What did he not hit with his trombone?
Why was he allowed to be so promiscuous?
Well,
Riker's got swag. What can I say?
I mean, I think when they were creating him, they wanted like a Kirk sort of, you know, type. So that was probably why, because Kirk, once they got to not, you know, it's funny because Kirk has a reputation as the womanizer.
Right.
It really wasn't until season 3 when they were just like every week like throwing a woman
right.
at him. Not really the case in season 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Whereas Riker, it seemed to be much more often. Right from the get-go, they're like, look at this guy.
Which I find hilarious. I think Jonathan Frakes, attractive dude, but do you think he's like the hunk? Like the typical Hollywood hunk?
If not him, who on the cast?
Yeah, well, that's a good
TNG,
question.
Who?
Yeah. No, but we have a mutual friend of ours, Katie. She finds Riker very attractive, though.
Yeah,
like
I think it's the caveman-esque
that kind of
burly
kind of
that lumbering sort
yeah.
of like. Well,
which it was perfect when they turned him into like a caveman in season 7 of Next Generation,
trying to crack that goldfish tank open with a rod.
Yeah, I know. Like I think the writers were having so much fun with that. Like when they turned him, they literally turned him into a caveman.
Didn't even
know?
Need that much makeup, just a little bit of forehead creases.
Do you think that
more...
was like an ongoing, like on set joke that they were finally getting
to
pay off?
I have to believe it because I've looked at interviews with like the writers and they said like one of their favorite things to do in the writers' room is just make fun of the cast.
Right.
And I'm sure the cast made fun of the writers and stuff. Well,
and if you see the, you know, the cast together at a con, they make fun of each other constantly.
Yeah.
So it's probably the vibe on set, too.
But from what I understand, like, the writers on Next Generation, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, they weren't allowed to go on set, which is a very bizarre...
Oh, really?
That's a very bizarre precedent in Hollywood, but it was implemented by, I believe, Rick Berman. Like, he did not want the writers on set for anything.
Why,
so.
Though? I mean, shouldn't the writers have some kind of relationship with... actors they're writing for?
And that's the thing, that's how it works, like all other like productions in television, but I don't know, they you know.
What about DS9 though? Because DS9 wasn't as much under, you know, Berman's control.
It was still very much like
still the same.
Yeah, like we don't want writers on set, or like writers just weren't allowed to go on set. I believe there were a lot of phone calls being made to the writers' room to get clarification for something.
That makes no sense from an efficiency standpoint.
I agree, but do you remember that one story that Armin Shimerman told us when we were at this Seattle con, and how if he had ever disagreed with the director? And he said that there was that one speech he was giving about how the Federation is like root beer. and he disagreed that with the director. The director wanted it played for laughs. Armin Shimerman.
What
wanted,
a nightmare that would have been.
I know, that was not
one
a
of
funny
Quark's
speech.
Greatest moments.
Yeah, but I mean, like, but Quark did it very deadpan, and then there's a big fight between him and the director, and so they ended up. I believe they had to call Iron Stephen Baer, the head writer of Deep Space Nine, and get clarification. It was originally written to be played for laughs, and then Iris Stephen Baer spoke to Armin Shimerman, and they're like, oh, well, you know what? I think you're right, Mr. Shimerman. Let's do a deadpan, you know, and which was great. That was such a great speech, and, like, I believe that was with Garak as well. Like, I
mean, yes, yeah.
You know.
And on that note, I believe our assignment is complete. So we've had our say on this week's topic. Here's what some of you had to say about last week's topic. Promote them or demote them?
Hi, this is Simon from Vancouver, and if I had the ultimate promotion-demotion powers given to me by CBS Starfleet, I would first get rid of Troy. I love the actress and her chemistry with Riker, but she rarely has anything interesting to do, and most of her showcase episodes are snoozers. Plus, she'd hopefully take her mother with her. That said, I'd enlist Guinan full-time. She'd fill the counselor role nicely and has an intriguing relationship with Picard. I'd love to see more of her, and her backstory is really enigmatic and cool. I want more of it, damn it. And who doesn't love Whoopi? Come on, Whoopi.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Beam your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. You can also send us a 30 to 60 second audio clip telling us your favorite or least favorite recreation episodes. You can also hit us up on the Twitters. I'm Cam, V as in Vedic, Smith. You booyah!
Nice improvisation there.
Wow, Cam. Anyways, I'm Tyler Orton, and you can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON.
B as in Burial _ YONG.
Yes! The streak continues. Until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.